The Psychology of Good Clothes, from the editors. Needless to say, clothing and what is acceptable to wear in business today is a far cry from what was considered appropriate in the early part of the 20th century. As you listen to the following, you may wonder what Napoleon Hill, who wore celluloid collars and spats, could have to say to a world where casual Friday is common and billion-dollar deals are signed by people dressed in blue jeans or sweats. The editors assure you that it will become abundantly clear that the philosophy behind the words supersedes the fashion of any particular era, and that, in fact, Hill's Psychology of Good Clothes has a much more significant point than "Can I wear checks with stripes?" Returning to Napoleon Hill's original text. When the good news came from the theater of war on November the 11th, 1918, my worldly possessions amounted to little more than they did the day I came into the world. The war had destroyed my business and made it necessary for me to make a new start. My wardrobe consisted of 3 well-worn business suits and 2 uniforms which I no longer needed. Knowing all too well that the world forms its first and most lasting impressions of a person by the clothes he or she wears, I lost no time in visiting my tailor. Happily, my tailor had known me for many years, therefore he did not judge me entirely by the clothes I wore. If he had, I would have been sunk. With less than a dollar and change in my pocket, I picked out the cloth for 3 of the most expensive suits I ever owned, and ordered that they be made up for me at once. The 3 suits came to $375. I shall never forget the remark made by the tailor as he took my measure, glancing first at the 3 bolts of expensive cloth that I had selected, and then at me he inquired, "Dollar a year, man, eh?" Editor's comment. The term "dollar a year man" was used to refer to those individuals who were wealthy enough to leave their businesses and contribute their time and skills to helping the government manage essential industries during the First World War. In exchange for helping with the war effort, they were paid $1 a year. Resuming Napoleon Hill's text. "No," said I, "if I had been fortunate enough to get on the dollar a year payroll, I might now have enough money to pay for these suits." The tailor looked at me with surprise. I don't think he got the joke. One of the suits was a beautiful dark gray, one was a dark blue, the other was a light blue with a pinstripe. Fortunately, I was in good standing with my tailor, therefore he did not ask when I was going to pay for those expensive suits. I knew that I could and would pay for them in due time, but could I have convinced him of that? This was the thought that was running through my mind with hope against hope that the question would not be brought up. I then visited my haberdasher, from whom I purchased 3 less expensive suits and a complete supply of the best shirts, collars, ties, hosiery, and underwear that he carried. With an air of prosperity, I nonchalantly signed the charge ticket. The feeling of renewed self-reliance and success had begun to come over me, even before I had attired myself in my newly purchased outfit. I was out of the war and $675 in debt, all in less than 24 hours. The following day, the first of the 3 suits ordered from the haberdasher was delivered. I put it on at once, stuffed a new silk handkerchief in the outside pocket of my coat, shoved the $50 I had borrowed on my ring down into my pants pocket, and walked down Michigan Avenue in Chicago feeling as rich as Rockefeller. Every morning I dressed myself in an entirely new outfit and walked down the same street at precisely the same hour. That hour happened to be the time when a certain wealthy publisher usually walked down the same street on his way to lunch. I made it my business to speak to him each day, and occasionally I would stop for a minute's chat with him. After this daily meeting had been going on for about a week, I met the publisher one day, but I decided I would see if he would let me get by him without our speaking to each other. Watching him from under my eyelashes, I looked straight ahead and started to pass him when he stopped and motioned me over to the edge of the sidewalk, placed his hand on my shoulder, looked me over from head to foot, and said, "You look damn prosperous for a man who has just laid aside a uniform. Who makes your clothes?" "Well," said I, "Wilkie and Celery made this particular suit." He then wanted to know what sort of business I was engaged in. I said, "Oh, I'm preparing the copy for a new magazine that I'm going to publish." "A new magazine, eh?" he queried. "And what are you going to call it?" "It is to be named Hill's Golden Rule." "Don't forget," said my publisher friend, "that I am in the business of printing and distributing magazines. Perhaps I can serve you also. That was the moment for which I had been waiting, and I can assure you that conversation never would have taken place had this publisher observed me walking down that street from day to day with a whipped dog look on my face, an unpressed suit on my back, and a look of poverty in my eyes. An appearance of prosperity attracts attention always, with no exceptions whatsoever. Moreover, a look of prosperity attracts favorable attention, because the one dominating desire in every human heart is to be prosperous. My publisher friend invited me to his club for lunch. Before the coffee and cigars had been served, he had talked me out of the contract for printing and distributing my magazine. I had even consented to permit him to supply the capital without any interest charge. For the benefit of those who are not familiar with the publishing business, let me point out that considerable capital is required for launching a new nationally distributed magazine. The capital necessary for launching Hill's Golden Rule magazine was well above $30,000, and every cent of it was raised because of the way I was dressed, and perhaps more important, the way it made me feel. To some, it may seem an unpardonable extravagance for one who was broke to have gone in debt for $675 worth of clothes, but the psychology back of that investment more than justified it. The appearance of prosperity not only made a favorable impression on those to whom I had to look for favors, but of more importance still was the effect that proper attire had on me. I not only knew that correct clothes would impress others favorably, but I also knew that good clothes would give me an atmosphere of self-reliance, without which I could not hope to regain my lost fortunes. I got my first training in the psychology of good clothes from my friend Edwin C. Barnes, whom I mentioned earlier had ridden into West Orange on a freight train, not being able to raise sufficient money for passenger fare. What I had not elaborated upon then is that when Mr. Barnes arrived, he had announced at the Edison offices that he had come to enter into a partnership with Mr. Edison. Nearly everybody around the Edison plant laughed at Barnes, except Edison himself. He saw something in the square jaw and determined face of young Barnes, which most of the others did not see, despite the fact that the young man looked more like a tramp than he did a future partner of the greatest inventor on Earth. Barnes got his start sweeping floors in the Edison offices. That was all he sought, just a chance to get a toehold in the Edison organization. From there on, he made history. He is a multimillionaire, prosperous and happy, and a close business associate of Thomas A. Edison's. He is now retired from active business, even though he is still a comparatively young man, and spends most of his time at his two beautiful homes in Bradentown, Florida, and Damariscotta, Maine. I first became acquainted with Barnes during the early days of his association with Edison before he had arrived. In those days, he had the largest and most expensive collection of clothes I had ever seen or heard of one man owning. His wardrobe consisted of 31 suits, one for each day of the month. He never wore the same suit 2 days in succession. One day, in a spirit of fun, I asked him to save some of his old suits that he did not need for me. He informed me that he hadn't had a single suit that he did not need. He then gave me a lesson on the psychology of clothes, which is well worth remembering. I do not wear 31 suits of clothes entirely for the impression they make on other people. I do it mostly for the impression they have on me. Barnes then told me of the day when he presented himself at the Edison plant for a position. He said he had to walk around the plant a dozen times before he worked up enough courage to announce himself, because he knew that he looked more like a tramp than he did a desirable employee. Barnes is said to be the most able salesman ever connected with the great inventor of West Orange. His entire fortune was made through his ability as a salesman, but he has often said that he could never have accomplished the results which have made him both wealthy and famous had it not been for his understanding of the psychology of clothes. I have met many salesmen in my time. During the past 10 years, I have personally trained and directed the efforts of more than 3,000 salespeople, both men and women, and I have observed that, without a single exception, the star producers were all people who understood and made good use of the psychology of clothes. I have yet to see the first poorly dressed salesperson who became a star producer. I have studied the psychology of clothes for so long, and I have watched its effect on people in so many different walks of life, that I am fully convinced there is a close connection between clothes and success. Personally, I feel no need of 31 suits of clothes, but if my personality demanded a wardrobe of this size, I would manage to get it no matter how much it might cost. It may be true, as a well-known poet has said, that clothes do not make the man, but no one can deny the fact that good clothes go a very long way toward giving him a favorable start. A bank will generally loan you all the money you want when you do not need it, when you are prosperous. But never go to your bank for a loan with a shabby-looking suit on your back and a look of poverty in your eyes, for if you do, you'll get the gate. Success attracts success. There is no escape from this great universal law. Therefore, if you wish to attract success, make sure that you look the part of success, whether your calling is that of day laborer or merchant prince. For the benefit of the more dignified students of this philosophy who may object to resorting to trick clothing as a means of achieving success, let me say that the real lesson here is that practically every successful person on earth has discovered some form of stimulus through which he can and does drive himself on to greater effort. Times too numerous to mention, I have gone into conference with colleagues who had the appearance of worry written all over them, only to see those same colleagues straighten up their shoulders, tilt their chins at a higher angle, soften their faces with smiles of confidence, and get down to business with that sort of enthusiasm which knows no defeat. The change took place the moment harmony of purpose was established. If a person goes about the affairs of life devoid of enthusiasm, he is doomed to failure. Nothing can save him until he changes his attitude and learns how to stimulate his mind and body to unusual heights of enthusiasm at will. Your business in life, you are reminded once again, is to achieve success. With the stimulus you will experience from studying this philosophy, you should be able to create a definite plan that will lift you to great heights of achievement. However, there is no plan that can produce this desirable result without the aid of some influence that will cause you to arouse yourself in a spirit of enthusiasm, to where you will exert greater than the ordinary effort that you put into your daily occupation. You are now ready for the lesson on self-control. As you listen to that lesson, you'll observe that it has a vital bearing on this lesson, just as this lesson has a direct connection with the preceding lessons on a definite chief aim, self-confidence, initiative and leadership, and imagination. The next lesson describes the law that serves as the balance wheel of this entire philosophy. The Seven Deadly Horsemen. An after-the-lesson visit with the author. The seven horsemen are labeled intolerance, greed, revenge, egotism, suspicion, jealousy, and... The worst enemy that anyone has is the one that walks around under his or her own hat. If you could see yourself as others see you, the enemies that you harbor in your own personality might be discovered and thrown out. The seven enemies named in this essay are the commonest, which ride millions of men and women to failure without being discovered. Your success will be measured very largely by the way you manage your battle against these swift riders. If these enemies rode openly, on real horses, they would not be dangerous because they could be rounded up and put out of commission. But they ride unseen, in our minds. So silently and subtly do they work that most people never recognize their presence. Take careful inventory of yourself and find out how many of these seven horsemen you are harboring. In the foreground, you'll find the most dangerous and the commonest of the riders. You will be fortunate if you discover this enemy and protect yourself against it. This cruel warrior, intolerance, has killed more people, destroyed more friendships, brought more misery and suffering into the world, and caused more wars than all of the other six horsemen. Until you master intolerance, you will never become an accurate thinker. This enemy of mankind closes up the mind and pushes reason and logic and facts into the background. If you find yourself hating those whose viewpoint is different from your own, you may be sure that the most dangerous of the seven deadly horsemen still rides in your brain. Next come revenge and greed. These riders travel side by side. Where one is found, the other is always close at hand. Greed warps and twists a person's brain so that he or she wants to build a fence around the earth and keep everyone else on the outside of it. This is the enemy that drives many to accumulate millions upon top of millions of dollars that they do not need and can never use. This is the enemy that causes many to twist the screw until they have wrung the last drop of blood from their fellow human being. And thanks to revenge, which rides alongside of greed, the unfortunate person who gives room to these cruel twins is not satisfied to merely take away a neighbor's earthly belongings. He wants to destroy the reputation of the other in the bargain. Revenge is a naked sword. It has neither hilt nor guard. Wouldst thou wield this brand of the Lord? Is thy grasp then firm and hard? But the closer thy clutch of the blade, the deadlier blow thou wouldst steal. Deeper wound in thy hand is made. It is thy blood reddens the steel. And when thou hast dealt the blow, when the blade from thy hand has flown, instead of the heart of the foe, thou mayst find it sheathed in thine own. If you would know how deadly are envy and greed, study the history of every person who has set out to become ruler of this world. If you do not wish to undertake so ambitious a program of research, then study the people around you, those who have tried and those who are now trying to feather their own nest at the cost of others. Greed and revenge stand at the crossroads of life, where they turn aside to failure and misery every person who would take the road that leads to success. It is a part of your business not to permit them to interfere with you when you approach one of these crossroads. Both individuals and nations rapidly decline where greed and envy ride in the minds of those who dominate. Most important of all, take a look at yourself and make sure that these two deadly enemies are not riding in your brain. Turn your attention now to two more twins of destruction, egotism and suspicion. Observe that they also ride side by side. There is no hope of success for the person who suffers either from too much self-love or lack of confidence in others. Someone who likes to manipulate figures has estimated that the largest club in the world is the "It Can't Be Done" club. If you have no faith in other people, you have not the seed of success in you. Suspicion is a prolific germ. If permitted to get a start, it rapidly multiplies itself until it leaves no room for faith. Without faith, no one may enjoy enduring success. Running like a golden cord of illumination throughout the Bible is the admonition to have faith. Before civilization lost itself in its mad rush for dollars, people understood the power of faith. For verily I say unto you, if ye have faith as a grain of mustard seed, ye shall say unto this mountain, Remove hence to yonder place, and it shall remove, and nothing shall be impossible unto you. The writer of this passage, which appears in the Bible, understood a great law which but few today understand. Believe in people if you would have them believe in you. Kill off suspicion. If you do not, it will kill you off. If you would have power, cultivate faith in humankind. Egotism thrives where suspicion exists. Interest yourself in others, and you will be too busy to indulge in self-love. Observe those around you who begin every sentence with the personal pronoun I, and you will notice that they are suspicious of other people. The person who can forget himself while engaging in useful service to other people is never cursed with suspicion. Study those about you who are both suspicious and egotistical, and see how many of this type you can name who are successful in whatever work they may be engaged in. And while making this study of others, study also yourself. Be sure that you are not bound down by egotism and suspicion. Bringing up the rear of this deadly group of riders are two more horsemen. One is jealousy, and the name of the other has been purposely omitted. Each listener may take inventory of himself and give the seventh rider a name that fits whatever he finds in his own mind. Some will name this rider dishonesty. Others will name it procrastination. A few will name it uncontrolled sex desire. As for you, name it whatever you please, but be sure to give it a name. Perhaps your own imagination will supply an appropriate name as a fellow traveler for jealousy. You will be better prepared to give the unnamed rider a name if you know that jealousy is a form of insanity. Facts are sometimes cruel things to face. It is a fact that jealousy is a form of insanity, known to the medical fraternity as dementia praecox. O jealousy, thou ugliest fiend of hell, thy deadly venom preys on my vitals, turns the healthful hue of my fresh cheek to haggard sallowness, and drinks my spirit up. You will notice that jealousy rides just back of suspicion. Some who hear this will say that jealousy and suspicion should have ridden side by side, as one often leads to the other in human mind. Jealousy is the most common form of insanity. It rides in the minds of both men and women, sometimes with real cause, but more often without any cause whatsoever. This deadly rider is a great friend of the divorce lawyers. It also keeps detective agencies busy night and day. It takes its regular toll of murder. It breaks up homes and makes widows of mothers and orphans of innocent little children. Peace and happiness can never be yours as long as this rider remains unharnessed in your brain. Man and wife may go through life together in poverty and still be very happy if both are free from this child of insanity known as jealousy. Examine yourself carefully, and if you find any evidence of jealousy in your mind, begin at once to master it. Jealousy rides in many forms. When it first begins to creep into the brain, it manifests itself into something after this fashion. I wonder where she is and what she is doing while I'm away. Or, I wonder if he does not see another woman when he's away from me. Get your foot on jealousy's neck before it gets its clutches on your throat. After you have heard this essay, lay it aside and think about it. At first you may say, this does not apply to me. I have no imaginary horseman in my brain. Do not fool yourself. The purpose of this article is to get you to see yourself as you are. If you are suffering failure and poverty and misery in any of their forms, you are sure to discover one or more of these deadly riders in your brain. Make no mistake about it. Those who have all they want, including happiness and good health, have driven the seven horsemen out of their brains. Come back to this essay a month from now, after you have had time to analyze yourself carefully. Listen to it again, and it may bring you face to face with facts that will emancipate you from a horde of cruel enemies that now ride within your brain without your knowing it. Lesson 8. Self-control. You can do it if you believe you can. In the preceding lesson, you learned of the value of enthusiasm. You also learned how to generate enthusiasm and how to transmit its influence to others through the principle of suggestion. You come now to the study of self-control, through which you may direct your enthusiasm to constructive ends. Without self-control, enthusiasm resembles the unharnessed lightning of an electrical storm. It may strike anywhere. It may destroy life and property. Enthusiasm is the vital quality that arouses you to action, while self-control is the balance wheel that directs your action so that it will build up and not tear down. Editor's comment. Self-control is the ability to direct your thoughts and thus your actions in the pursuit of your definite chief aim. In a very large sense, every lesson of the Law of Success is about self-control, but in this chapter, we will explore the issue with specific regard to your dealings with other people. And now back to Napoleon Hill's original text. To be a person who is well-balanced, you must be a person in whom enthusiasm and self-control are equalized. A survey which I have just completed of 160,000 adult inmates of penitentiaries in the United States discloses the startling fact that 92% of these unfortunate men and women are in prison because they lack the necessary self-control to direct their energies constructively. These figures are startling. It is a fact that the majority of our personal grief comes about through lack of self-control. The Holy Scriptures are full of admonition and support of self-control. They even urge us to love our enemies and forgive those who injure us. Study the records of those whom the world calls great, and observe that every one of them possesses this quality of self-control. For example, study the characteristics of our own immortal Lincoln. In the midst of his most trying hours, he exercised patience, poise, and self-control. These were some of the qualities that made him the great man that he was. He found disloyalty in some of the members of his cabinet, but for the reason that this disloyalty was toward him personally, and because those in whom he found it had qualities which made them valuable to his country, Lincoln exercised self-control and disregarded the objectionable qualities. How many people do you know who have self-control to equal this? In language more forceful than it was polished, Billy Sunday exclaimed from the pulpit, "There is something as rotten as hell about the man who is always trying to show some other fellow up." I wonder if the devil didn't yell, "Amen, brother," when Billy made that statement. However, self-control becomes an important factor in this course on the Law of Success, because those who do not exercise it suffer the loss of a great power that they need in their struggle for achievement of their definite chief aim. If you neglect to exercise self-control, you are not only likely to injure others, but you are sure to injure yourself. During the early part of my public career, I discovered what havoc lack of self-control was playing in my life. This discovery taught me one of the most important lessons I have ever learned. It came about in this way. One day, in the building in which I had my office, the janitor and I had a misunderstanding. This led to a most violent form of mutual dislike between us. As a means of showing his contempt for me, this janitor would switch off the lights when he knew that I was there alone at work in my study. This happened on several occasions until I finally decided to strike back. My opportunity came one Sunday when I came to my study to prepare an address that I had to deliver the following night. I had hardly seated myself at my desk when off went the lights. I jumped to my feet and ran toward the basement of the building where I knew I would find the janitor. When I arrived, I found him busily engaged shoveling coal into the furnace and whistling as though nothing unusual had happened. Without ceremony, I pitched into him, and for 5 minutes I hurled adjectives at him which were hotter than the fire that he was feeding. Finally, I ran out of words and had to slow down. Then he straightened himself up, looked back over his shoulder, and in a calm, smooth tone of voice that was full of poise and self-control, and with a smile on his face that reached from ear to ear, he said, "Why, you're just a little bit excited this morning, ain't you?" That remark cut as though it had been a stiletto. Imagine my feelings as I stood there before a man who could neither read nor write, but who, despite this handicap, had defeated me in a duel that had been fought on ground and with the weapon of my own choice. My conscience pointed an accusing finger at me. I knew that not only had I been defeated, but what was worse, I knew that I was the aggressor and that I was in the wrong, which only served to intensify my humiliation. Not only did my conscience point an accusing finger at me, but it placed some very embarrassing thoughts in my mind. It mocked me, and it tantalized me. There I stood, a boasted student of advanced psychology, an exponent of the Golden Rule philosophy, having at least a fair acquaintance with the works of Shakespeare, Socrates, Plato, Emerson, and the Bible. Facing me stood a man who knew nothing of literature or philosophy, but who had, despite this lack of knowledge, whipped me in a battle of words. I turned and went back to my office as rapidly as I could go. There was nothing else for me to do. As I began to think the matter over, I saw my mistake. But, true to nature, I was reluctant to do what I knew must be done to right the wrong. I knew that I would have to apologize to that man before I could place myself at peace in my own heart, much less with him. Finally, I made up my mind to go back down to the basement and suffer this humility which I knew I had to undergo. The decision was not easily reached, nor did I reach it quickly. I started down, but I walked more slowly than I had when I went down the first trip. I was trying to think how I would make the second approach so as to suffer the least humiliation possible. When I got to the basement, I called to the janitor to come over to the door. In a calm, kindly tone of voice, he asked, "What do you wish this time?" I informed him that I had come back to apologize for the wrong I had done, if he would permit me to do so. Again, that smile spread all over his face as he said, "For the love of the Lord, you don't have to apologize. Nobody heard you except these four walls and you and me. I ain't going to tell it, and I know you ain't going to tell it, so just forget it." And that remark hurt more than his first one, for he had not only expressed a willingness to forgive me, but he had actually indicated his willingness to help me cover up the incident so nobody would know. I walked over to him and took him by the hand. I shook with more than my hand, I shook with my heart. And as I walked back to my office, I felt good for having summoned the courage with which to right the wrong I had done. This is not the end of the story. It is only the beginning. Following this incident, I made a resolution that I would never again place myself in a position in which another human being could humiliate me because I had lost my self-control. Following that resolution, a remarkable change began to take place in me. My pen began to take on greater power. My spoken words began to carry greater weight. I began to make more friends and fewer enemies among my acquaintances. The incident marked one of the most important turning points of my life. It taught me that no one can control others unless he first controls himself. it gave me a clear conception of the philosophy behind these words. Whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad. It also gave me a clear conception of the law of non-resistance. This incident placed in my hands the passkey to a storehouse of knowledge that is illuminating and helpful in all that I do, and later in life, when enemies sought to destroy me, it gave me a powerful weapon of defense that has never failed me. Lack of self-control is the average salesman's most damaging weakness. In one of the large department stores of Chicago, I witnessed an incident that illustrated the importance of self-control. A long line of people was in front of the complaint desk, telling their troubles and the store's faults to the young woman in charge. Some were angry and unreasonable, and some of them made very ugly remarks. The young woman at the desk received the disgruntled customers without the slightest sign of resentment at their remarks. With a smile on her face, she directed them to the proper departments with such charming grace and poise that I marveled at her self-control. Standing just back of her was another young woman who was making notations on slips of paper and passing them in front of her as the customers in the line unburdened their troubles. These slips of paper contained the gist of what the women in line were saying, minus the vitriolic coloring and the anger. The smiling young woman at the desk, who was supposedly hearing the complaints, was in actuality deaf. Her assistant supplied her with all the necessary facts through those slips of paper. I was so impressed with the plan that I sought the manager of the store and interviewed him. He informed me that he had selected a deaf woman for one of the most trying and important positions in the store for the reason that he had not been able to find any other person with sufficient self-control to fill the place. Ever since I witnessed that scene, I have thought of the poise and self-control of that young woman at the desk every time I felt myself becoming irritated at remarks that I did not like. Often, I have thought that everybody should have a set of mental earmuffs, which they could slip over their ears at times. Life is too short, and there is too much constructive work to be done to justify us in striking back at everyone who says that which we do not wish to hear. As I stood and watched that line of angry people, I observed what pleasant effect the smile of the young woman at the desk had upon them. Even those who came before her growling like wolves often went away as meek and quiet as sheep. The young woman's self-control had made them ashamed of themselves. Those who control themselves usually boss the job, no matter what it may be. No doubt all people who refuse or neglect to exercise self-control are literally turning opportunity after opportunity away without knowing it. One rainy afternoon, an old lady walked into a Pittsburgh department store and wandered around in an aimless sort of way, very much in the manner that people who have no intention of buying often do. Most of the salespeople gave her the once-over and busied themselves by straightening the stock on their shelves so as to avoid being troubled by her. One of the young men saw her and made it his business to inquire politely if he might serve her. She informed him that she was only waiting for it to stop raining, that she did not wish to make any purchases. The young man assured her that she was welcome, and by engaging her in conversation, made her feel that he had meant what he said. When she was ready to go, he accompanied her to the street and raised her umbrella for her. She asked for his card and went on her way. The incident had been forgotten by the young man when, one day, he was called into the office by the head of the firm and shown a letter from a lady who wanted a salesman to go to Scotland and take an order for the furnishings for a mansion. That lady was Andrew Carnegie's mother. She was also the same woman whom the young man had so courteously escorted to the street many months previously. In the letter, Mrs. Carnegie specified that this young man was the one whom she desired to be sent to take her order. That order amounted to an enormous sum, and the incident brought the young man an opportunity for advancement that he might never have had except for his courtesy to an old lady who did not look like a ready sale. Just as the great fundamental laws of life are wrapped up in the commonest sort of everyday experiences that most of us never notice, so are the real opportunities often hidden in the seemingly unimportant transactions of life. Ask the next 10 people whom you meet why they have not accomplished more in their respective lines of endeavor, and at least 9 of them will tell you that the opportunity does not seem to come their way. Go a step further and analyze each of these 9 accurately by observing their actions for one single day, and the chances are that you will find that every one of them is turning away the finest sort of opportunities every hour of the day. One day I went to visit a friend who was associated with a commercial school. When I asked him how he was getting along, he replied, "Rotten. I see a large number of people, but I am not making enough sales to give me a good living. I am thinking about changing positions as there is no opportunity here." It happened that I was on my vacation and had 10 days' time that I could use as I wished. So I challenged his remark that he had no opportunity by telling him that I could turn his position into $250 in a week's time and show him how to make it worth that every week thereafter. He looked at me in amazement and asked me not to joke with him over so serious a matter. When he was finally convinced that I was in earnest, he ventured to inquire how I would perform the miracle. I informed him that by using organized effort, he could enroll from 5 to 10 students with the same amount of effort that he had been putting into the enrollment of one or of none. He said he was willing to be shown, so I asked him to arrange for me to speak before the employees of one of the local department stores. He made the appointment, and I delivered the address. In my talk, I outlined a plan through which the employees could not only increase their ability so that they could earn more money in their present positions, but it also offered them an opportunity to prepare themselves for greater responsibilities and better positions. Following my talk, which of course was designed for that purpose, my friend enrolled 8 of those employees for night courses in the commercial school that he represented. The following night, he booked me for a similar address before the employees of a laundry, and following the address, he enrolled 3 more students, 2 of them young women who worked over the washing machines at the hardest sort of labor. 2 days later, he booked me for an address before the employees of one of the local banks, and following the address, he enrolled 4 more students, making a total of 15 students. The entire time consumed was not more than 6 hours, including the time required for the delivery of the address and the enrollment of the students. My friend's commission on the transaction was a little over $400. These places of employment were within 15 minutes' walk of this man's place of business, but he had not thought of looking there for business nor aligned himself with a speaker to assist him in group selling. That man now owns a highly successful commercial school of his own. No opportunities come your way? Perhaps they come, but you do not see them. Perhaps you will see them in the future as you are preparing yourself through the law of success so that you can recognize an opportunity when you see it. The 6th lesson of this course was on the subject of imagination, which is the chief factor in this story. Imagination plus a definite plan plus self-confidence plus action were the main factors that entered into this transaction. You now know how to use all of these, and before you have finished this lesson, you will understand how to direct these factors through self-control. Now, let us examine the scope of meaning of the term self-control. A person with well-developed self-control does not indulge in hatred, envy, jealousy, fear, revenge, or any similar destructive emotions. A person with well-developed self-control does not go into ecstasies or become ungovernably enthusiastic over anything or anybody. Greed and selfishness and excessive self-approval indicate lack of self-control in one of its most dangerous forms. Self-confidence is one of the important essentials of success, but when this faculty is developed beyond the point of reason, it becomes very dangerous. Self-sacrifice is a commendable quality, but when it is carried to extremes, it also becomes one of the dangerous forms of lack of self-control. You owe it to yourself not to permit your emotions to place your happiness in the keeping of another person. Love is essential for happiness, but the person who loves so deeply that his or her happiness is placed entirely in the hands of another is literally out of control. A person with well-developed self-control will not permit himself to be influenced by the cynic or the pessimist, nor will he permit another person to do his thinking for him. A person with well-developed self-control will stimulate his imagination and his enthusiasm until they have produced action, but he will then control that action and not permit it to control him. A person with well-developed self-control will never, under any circumstances, slander another person or seek revenge for any cause whatsoever. A person with self-control will not hate those who do not agree with him. Instead, he will endeavor to understand the reason for their disagreement and profit by it. We come now to a form of lack of self-control that causes more grief than all other forms combined. It is the habit of forming opinions before studying the facts. You will find that this subject is covered more fully in Volume 3 of The Law of Success and the section on Accurate Thinking. But the subject of self-control could not be covered without at least a passing reference to this common evil to which we are all more or less addicted. No one has any right to form an opinion that is not based either upon that which he believes to be facts or upon a reasonable hypothesis. Yet, if you'll observe yourself carefully, you will catch yourself forming opinions on nothing more substantial than your desire for a thing to be or not to be. Another grievous form of lack of self-control is the habit of spending beyond one's needs. I am safe in assuming that you are struggling to attain success, for if you were not, you would not be studying this course. Let me remind you, then, that a little savings account will attract many an opportunity to you that would not come your way without it. The size of the account is not so important as is the fact that you have established the habit of saving. For this habit marks you as a person who exercises an important form of self-control. The modern tendency of those who work for a salary is to spend it all. If a person who receives $15,000 a year and manages to get along on it fairly well receives an increase of $1,000 a year, does he continue to live on $15,000 and place the increased portion of his income into savings or investments? No, not unless he is one of the few people who have developed the savings habit. Then, what does he do with his additional $1,000? He trades in the old automobile and buys a new, more expensive one. And at the end of the year, he is poorer on a $16,000 income than he was the previous year on a $15,000 income. Somewhere between the miser who hoards every penny he gets his hands on in an old sock and the person who spends every cent he can earn or borrow, there is a happy medium. If you enjoy life with reasonable assurance of average freedom and contentment, you must find this halfway point and adopt it as part of your self-control program. Self-discipline is the most essential factor in the development of personal power. It enables you to control your appetite and your tendency to spend more than you earn and your habit of striking back at those who offend you and the other destructive habits which cause you to dissipate your energies through non-productive effort that takes on forms too numerous to be cataloged in this lesson. Very early in my public career, I was shocked when I learned how many people there are who devote most of their energies to tearing down that which the builders construct. By some queer turn of the wheel of fate, one of these destroyers crossed my path by making it his business to try to destroy my reputation. At first, I was inclined to strike back at him, but as I sat at my typewriter late one night, a thought came to me which changed my entire attitude toward this man. Removing the sheet of paper that was in my typewriter, I inserted another one on which I stated this thought and these words. You have a tremendous advantage over the man who does you an injury. You have it within your power to forgive him, while he has no such advantage over you. As I finished writing those lines, I made up my mind that I had come to the point at which I had to decide upon a policy that would serve as a guide concerning my attitude toward those who criticize my work or try to destroy my reputation. I reached this decision by reasoning something after this fashion. Two courses of action were open to me. I could waste much of my time and energy in striking back, or I could devote this energy to furthering my life work and let the result of that work serve as my sole answer to all who would criticize my efforts or question my motives. I decided upon the latter as being the better policy and adopted it. By their deeds you shall know them. If your deeds are constructive and you are at peace with yourself in your own heart, you will not find it necessary to stop and explain your motives, for they will explain themselves. The world soon forgets its destroyers. It builds its monuments to and bestows its honors upon none but its builders. Keep this fact in mind, and you will more easily reconcile yourself to the policy of refusing to waste your energies by striking back at those who offend you. Every person who amounts to anything in this world comes to the point, sooner or later, at which he is forced to settle this question of policy toward his enemies. If you want proof that it pays to exercise sufficient self-control to refrain from dissipating your vital energies by striking back, then study the records of all who have risen to high stations in life and observe how carefully they curb this destructive habit. It is a well-known fact that no one ever reached a high station in life without opposition of a violent nature from jealous and envious enemies. The late President Warren G. Harding and ex-President Wilson and John H. Patterson of the National Cash Register Company and scores of others whom I could mention were victims of this cruel tendency of a certain type of depraved human being to destroy reputations. But these people wasted no time explaining or striking back at their enemies. They exercised self-control. It may even be that these attacks, cruel and unjust and untruthful as they are, serve a good purpose. In my own case, I know that I made a discovery that was of great value to me as a result of a series of bitter attacks which a journalist launched against me. I paid no attention to these attacks for 4 or 5 years until finally they became so bold that I decided to override my policy and strike back at my antagonist. I sat down at my typewriter and began to write. In all of my experience as a writer, I do not believe I ever assembled such a collection of biting adjectives as those which I used on this occasion. The more I wrote, the more angry I became, until I had written all that I could think of on the subject. As the last line was finished, a strange feeling came over me. It was not a feeling of bitterness toward the person who had tried to injure me. It was a feeling of compassion, of sympathy, of forgiveness. I had unconsciously psychoanalyzed myself by releasing, over the keys of my typewriter, the repressed emotions of hate and resentment that I had been unintentionally gathering in my subconscious mind over a long period of years. Now, if I find myself becoming very angry, I sit down at my typewriter and write it out of my system, then throw away the manuscript. Or I file it away so I can refer back in the years to come, after the evolutionary processes of time have given me greater understanding. Editor's Commentary. Elsewhere, Hill writes about a negative experience that motivated him. I was once engaged by the Chamber of Commerce in a small town to deliver a series of lectures. One citizen took it upon himself to announce that I was a charlatan who was riding into town to fleece the locals of their hard-earned cash. He caused no small amount of grief to the people who had hired me, and frankly piqued my anger a little. So I took my entire fee for the lectures and bought airtime on the local radio station, and I delivered my talks free to a much larger audience than could have fit into the hall where I was supposed to speak. I must admit that I caused quite a sensation, creating favorable publicity for myself and for the Chamber of Commerce. I made no money on that actual transaction, but I did keep myself from becoming engaged in a fruitless battle. I answered the Doubting Thomas's charges in a way that completely obliterated them without once sacrificing my dignity or credibility. I like to think, in fact, that my words carried an extra weight in that town and did far more good than they might otherwise have. Returning now to Napoleon Hill's original text from The Law of Success. Repressed emotions, especially the emotion of hatred, resemble a bomb that has been constructed of high explosives, and unless they are handled as an expert would handle a bomb, they are as dangerous. A bomb may be rendered harmless by explosion in an open field, or by disintegration in a bath of the proper sort. Also, a feeling of anger or hatred may be rendered harmless by giving expression to it in a manner that harmonizes with the principle of psychoanalysis.